From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. There are more lawyers per capita in the United States than anywhere else in the world. And today, some of the highest paid lawyers in the land are scrambling in a cold sweat. Dewey and LaBeouf, the once mighty New York law firm, is melting down. Legal profession insiders say it's one sign of trouble in the wider business of law. From law students to paralegals to plutocrats, they say a whole structure is shaking here and a shakeout underway. This hour On Point, the business of law in trouble. You can join the conversation. Remember when the law looked like a surefire profession, sweet billing in the day and comfy pipe and slippers in the evening? What's happening here? Lawyers, what is going on? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later this hour, we will check back in with New York University's law professor Jerome Cohen about China's barefoot lawyer, blind activist Chen Guangcheng, and the stunning U.S.-China deal today for his freedom. And in a moment, we'll hear from two big legal minds about what is happening with the law industry nationally. But first, the crisis at Dewey and LaBeouf. Joining me from New York is Jennifer Smith, legal affairs reporter for The Wall Street Journal. She's here with the latest. Jennifer, thank you for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Share with us first, if you would, just a sense of how big this firm was and how it got so big so fast.
Well, Dewey and LaBeouf is the product of what at the time was one of the bigger mergers in the legal world. It took two old line New York firms and in 2007 combined them. And it became this entity that was one of the biggest New York law firms, and it had about 1,400 lawyers across the globe, a sort of a real international presence.
And now everybody's watching as what is happening, Jennifer?
Well, that's an excellent question. To put this in context, as you mentioned, it's been a challenging couple of years for what they call big law, the sort of big law firms that charge high rates to corporate clients. So it's been a pretty challenging environment.
Because of the recession, their corporate clients didn't want to shell out like they had.
Exactly. They're pushing back. So all of a sudden, business that was so abundant has sort of scaled back. And the bet that the chairman of Dewey and LaBeouf, Stephen Davis, took at the time of the merger, it was this ambitious goal to really create a global law firm with a big New York presence that could kind of take on the elite Wall Street firms that had traditionally really dominated the higher echelon of corporate work. That's what they wanted to do, but what they didn't plan on was the fact that demand would really just sort of bottom out after the events in late 2008. But Dewey and LaBeouf had some other things going on as well. They also had a pretty heavy debt load and sort of unusual method of compensation that over the years actually sort of undermined its ability to turn a profit.
A real high-wire game they were playing where they were guaranteeing top partners who were often poached, I guess is the word that's been used here, from other firms. They were guaranteeing them big compensation packages, not based on, well, if you bill such and such, you'll make thus and such, but you will make X million per year.
That's true. And there some of these people really were, the pillars of the business, bringing in, huge amounts of business and being well compensated for it. That's all well and good. But it sort of points to a larger trend in the legal world, which is sort of instead of each lawyer in a firm getting a share of the profits and their sort of, fortunes rise and fall with the fortunes of the firm, when you separate things out and guarantee people's pay regardless of how well a firm does, at the end of the day, that means that the people without these sorts of agreements and guarantees have a much smaller portion left over than they would normally.
The last few days, weeks have been just, we're reading shell-shocked, funereal out of Dewey and LaBeouf. Scores of partners have left, taken a lot of clients with them. What's the latest you're hearing out of the firm itself, and what's going on there?
So the latest out of the firm, it's been, as we and other outlets have reported, since January, there's really been a stream of partners leaving. And the reason that that's key is because the assets that law firms have, it's the talent. And everybody in the law business says, and it's true, that their assets go, out of the office and down into the elevator every single day. So when partners leave, it can make people very concerned and cause other partners to leave, almost like a bank run. And it also makes lenders nervous because, you know, if you're losing partners, if they're good partners who are bringing in business, the more that they leave, you know, the less ability a firm may have to repay debts that it owes. So this had been happening since January, but it really has sort of precipitated into something of a free-for-all over the last couple weeks.
90 of the firm's 300 partners gone since January. I mean, and this is really sort of way up near the top of the pyramid. I mean, they had 10 floors at 1301 Avenue of the Americas, very she-she address. These were the elegant wood-paneled offices, the New York Times reports that were used for scenes in the George Clooney legal thriller, Michael Clayton. I mean, this was deep gravy when it was good.
Mm-hmm. It's true. And you know, it was an ambitious firm, very, very smart lawyers, people, you know, and some lawyers who can command, you know, tremendous prices, billing $1,000 an hour. So it's quite a shift. It's quite a downshift. And I think it's caught a number of people who work there off guard, both partners. And then, of course, you know, the vast array of people who support the enterprise who really had no say in the management decisions that sort of led the firm to where it is today.
And a lot of people who were not making millions in the firm, of course. What about the chairman at this point, Stephen Davis? He's out. There's talk of criminal charges. What about bankruptcy? Where are things headed?
It's hard to know. On Friday, word came out that the Manhattan District Attorney's Office was investigating activities at the firm. According to firm leaders, who no longer include Stephen Davis, the investigation is focused on Mr. Davis, who has since retained legal counsel and has been stripped of his leadership duties, although he is still a partner with the firm. On other fronts, there's a group of about four partners who are sort of at the helm right now, and they're talking with other law firms, trying to see if they can coordinate maybe a merger or offload some lawyers to another firm. They're sort of trying to figure out how to essentially salvage some value, you know, from what's left. But it's a difficult time. They have said most recently that they're, you know, that they don't plan to file for bankruptcy, but it's hard to see, you know, where this could go.
It's a mess.
It's a pretty grim situation right now, it would seem, you know, and they're also still negotiating with lenders on a pretty substantial credit line.
Jennifer, you know, this is not my world, but I've been kind of fascinated with the rapt fascination of much of New York and the wider legal world with this. I mean, just staring almost in horror at what's going on here. What is it about the case of this one very large firm that's got so many people, so many lawyers' attention around the country, the world?
Well, it's interesting. Law firm failures were once pretty unheard of. There have been a couple sort of big ones. A firm called Finley Kumbel, a decade or so back, had a pretty spectacular failure. But the pace really picked up over the past decade. There have been some high profile sort of crashes and burns, and there seems to be a sort of the people, I think, are drawn to this storyline often if they're firms that were sort of really trying something new or sort of an ambitious go, you know, almost sort of an Icarus type scenario. There seems to be that seems to be sort of turning heads, you know. So with Dewey and LaBeouf, what you have, if you know, this is one of the it's I believe the biggest firm to be undergoing so public a tumult, and if the firm does end up failing, we believe it would be, if not the biggest, one of the biggest such failures sort of in the U.S. law scene. It's just huge. It's New York based. They've got lots of hope of high profile lawyers. You know, it was a pretty ambitious experiment. That, you know, there was a lot of you know, they sort of really trumpeted this as the next thing at the time of the merger, and to see it come to this, it's got some people fascinated, and I think it also has a lot of people at law firms, you know, looking at themselves and their firms and wondering if the next shoe is going to drop. People are wondering if we'll be seeing more law firm failures in the months and years to come.
Jennifer Smith, legal affairs reporter with the Wall Street Journal. Thank you for joining us from New York, Jennifer.
Thank you.
With us right now from Atlanta is Michael Trotter, partner at the law firm Taylor English Duma. He's practiced corporate law for five decades. His new book is Declining Prospects, how extraordinary competition and compensation are changing America's major law firms. Michael Trotter, welcome to On Point. Thanks very much for being here.
Thank you, Tom. I'm glad to be here.
We just have a minute before the break, but your thoughts as you're watching all this go on in New York from your seat there in Atlanta, what's the significance of this big firm shaking so deeply, so publicly?
Tom, there's been a fundamental change in the competitive environment in the law firm world, particularly among the top firms who are generally referred to as the Am Law 100 or 200. And it's not just mistakes, I think, that Dewey may have made, but it is a problem that is faced, a number of the major law firms are faced with. We had 10 of the 100 largest firms in 1985 that have gone under. Dewey is probably the most prominent of that. I think the fact that Governor Dewey was a candidate for president of the United States and his name was number one has something to do with that prominence.
Roots back to 1909, this firm, and now nobody knows what its future holds. We're going to look with you, Michael Trotter. We're very glad to have you with us at the wider law scene and what's going on with the business of law. Later in this hour, we will go to the case in Beijing of the blind barefoot lawyer and the big U.S.-China deal there today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about the business of law in trouble, the legal profession in the midst of a kind of revolution. Nobody knows where it ends. Michael Trotter is with us from the big firm Taylor English Duma in Atlanta, 5 decades in the profession, and a new book out, Declining Prospects, that kind of says it all. With us as well in this hour from Stanford, California today is William Henderson. He's director of the Center on the Global Legal Profession at Indiana University's Maurer School of Law. Bill Henderson, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Tom. I'm glad to be here.
We put it to Michael Trotter in Atlanta, but you there, your thoughts as we see Dewey and LaBeouf sort of on fire in New York, and not in a good way.
Yeah, Dewey LaBeouf is the biggest failure we've had since the rise of big law. The only exception to it would be Finley Kemble, which was a major New York law firm that kind of came out of nowhere in the late 1970s to become this big mega firm. But it was built upon lateral star talent. What I mean by lateral star talent is they started poaching lawyers from other law firms during the 1970s and 1980s, which was unprecedented. It was the beginning of a new era. And they were the second largest firm in America, and they went down in flames in 1987, which was the first year of the Am Law 100. We haven't seen a implosion this big since Finley Kemble. And one thing that's noteworthy about Finley Kemble and Dewey LaBeouf is it seems like Dewey LaBeouf migrated toward the same business practices that did Finley Kemble in. In other words, they poached lateral partners and they guaranteed them a lot of money.
Michael Trotter, you've been in the business a long time, and now we're seeing, here's a big name. Bill Henderson is mentioning others that have seen trouble. People are talking about a kind of revolution in this industry. I don't know if it's ultimately for the country, for the good or bad, for people in it. It's hard, that's for sure. Michael Trotter, would you advise your, I don't know at this point, grandchild or great-grandchild to go into the law?
Tom, I don't think so. The legal profession has been producing, the law schools have been producing far more lawyers each year in recent years than there are jobs for them. We're graduating around 45,000 law students every year, and at best there's about 25,000 new jobs. So this has led over time to a tremendous increase in the amount of competition among law firms. There's a key factor about the law firms, about the legal business, that differentiates it from every other major business in the United States, and that is that every lawyer is a perpetual, unlimited free agent.
I.e., they could go anywhere, anytime with their client list, I guess.
That is correct. The model rule of professional conduct of the American Bar Association, rule number 5.6, basically prohibits non-compete, non-solicitation contracts among lawyers and law firms. And the result is that the partners in any of these major firms are free to leave anytime they like and take their clients with them.
And when they do, that can be a lot of business out the door. Bill Henderson, you got people listening closely because we've seen so many industries get into trouble in this country. And when any industry gets in trouble, people pay attention. But a lot of listeners are writing to us and saying, you know, why should I care? These have been well-paid, maybe too well-paid, you know, tip-top lawyers, so they've got trouble now. Hey, cry me a river. Lots of industries have had trouble. Why should an ordinary American who's not a top corporate lawyer care about Dewey LaBeouf and all the rest?
Well, I think that it's just well, I think that I'd be sympathetic to the ordinary American. Why should they care? These are extraordinarily wealthy people. I think it's just the spectacle of what we're observing that does signal a sea change. I think what I would say is Dewey LaBeouf and their spectacular failure suggest that we're moving from a time where you can think of the legal profession to a legal services industry. And I think that this would be one of the landmarks or road signs along the way that suggest that we're moving to a legal services industry. Now, I'm not saying that professional norms are not important or the profession is not important. I know you'll get a lot of angry readers that are listeners that will object to me saying the legal services industry. But it's just too expensive to provide services to a sophisticated client using the high-end New York model. And I think that we have reached the plateau of that, and that model is going to flatten out and maybe go down in the years to come. So I guess it's important because it's the apex, and now we're on the plateauing and slow leveling off of this very important and very prestigious and very lucrative industry.
Mr. Trotter, does that mean a more technology-driven law world? Does it mean a lower pay law world?
I think it probably means both, Tom. The technology is clearly one of the factors that's increased competition in the profession. At one time, proximity to your client was a very important consideration. But now most of us have become accustomed to dealing with other people over the long-distance telephone and the internet and the fax machine, email, so that it is now possible for lawyers anywhere in the English-speaking world to compete for business anywhere in the English-speaking world anytime. You're getting outsourcing of some work to India. You're getting work moved out of the large cities to smaller cities where the cost of the legal service is lower. And this has greatly increased competition among law firms.
And so the heat is on. Michael Trotter, William Henderson, please stand by. A lot of listeners calling in. Linda in Saratoga Springs, New York. Thanks for calling, Linda. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Good to be here. I'm a great fan. My comment or observation is of 29 years of being married to an attorney. My father-in-law is an attorney.
Okay.
Both my brother-in-laws are attorneys.
Okay.
So I know of what I speak. I could talk somebody out of being a lawyer in 5 minutes or less.
Why?
Why? Well, my husband has a small private firm. It is no longer a profession. It's a business. It's a black and white business. We still have weeks where we don't get paid, where payroll comes first before us. I have another brother-in-law who went from the public sector to the private sector. Now he's back at the public sector where he can get a paycheck, a guaranteed paycheck. I have another brother-in-law in a huge firm out in San Francisco who's in his late 40s who still does 100 hours a week and still does overnights, working through the night to make a goal. Why? To keep his level of partnership and maybe to get to the next level.
Yeah.
I have a father-in-law who's still practicing law. It is not what it was in the early 80s. Up until the mid-80s, it was still a profession. And then we got into more and more commercials, marketing, and undercutting. It has changed.
And in 5 minutes, you could talk anybody out of going into it. Linda, we hear that part loud and clear. I hope things work out, but I appreciate your call. Let me get one more. Brian in Hartford, Connecticut. Brian, you're on.
Yes, hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
My feeling is really that the at the beginning of the economic decline, you actually saw per partner profits at the large, at big law firms stay stable or actually increase. And what that indicates to me is that the firms were actually, you know, sort of hoarding money at the profit, at the partner level, and gutting their associate rank, which then reduced their ability, of course, to meet the market demands that clients wanted to just pay less.
Yeah.
So now, to some extent, firms, big firms that, you know, got caught up in a in merger frenzy, are reaping what they sowed.
So in a way, you see some just desserts going on here. We'll look at that, and I appreciate your call. And one more, we'll come back to Michael and Bill, but Rose in Pittsburgh. Rose, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Well, thank you for having me. I have a complete different perspective.
Mm-hmm.
I am the quintessential sole practitioner, to say. I own a storefront.
Hang out the shingle kind of a lawyer, attorney.
Hang out. I've done it. And I was very fortunate where I didn't graduate with a lot of law, school debt, and I went after. I didn't become a lawyer until I was in my 30s.
Mm-hmm.
My perspective is this. There is not enough lawyers for the blue-collar guy on the corner. I represent the guy who's making the 12, 15 bucks an hour, 20 bucks an hour,
yep,
trying to navigate divorce, trying to navigate tenant-landlord law.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I was sitting at a coffee shop in downtown Pittsburgh, and one of the partners for one of the major law firms happened to be sitting at the next table with a bunch of his cronies.
Yeah.
This man was complaining because his wife could only buy one quarter horse that year, bragging that he drank a $400 bottle of wine.
So you're not too sympathetic when Dewey and LaBeouf has got some problems?
Absolutely not.
Rose, we've got it. You make it absolutely vivid. Bill Henderson, I mean, there's the range of people, you know, sort of people from inside the business, all in the family, saying don't come in here. You know, our caller from Hartford saying they've just hoarded profits too much among partners, cut out capacity to serve, and of course they're in trouble. And there's Rose that says, what about the rest of America that doesn't pay $500 an hour for a lawyer? Can't, and she's not sympathetic to what's going on at the big firms. What do you say, Bill?
I don't think that the public should be sympathetic for millionaire partners that are having a hard time holding their partnerships together. I'm with the masses on that one for sure. I think Rose in particular raises a really good point. Just because we have it seems like a meltdown taking place doesn't mean we don't have a lot of unmet legal need. And because large law firms paid so much because they were serving corporate clientele so far, we focused a lot of attention on that. But there's massive underserved segments of society that just can't afford an ordinary lawyer. It sounds to me like Rose has developed a practice where she's trying to serve the ordinary citizen. Now, you need technology in order to serve that constituency and turn a profit. And so I suspect that she's very entrepreneurial and very tech savvy in order to earn a living. But the good news, I think, from this meltdown is that we are going to migrate toward a new model where the average business, the average citizen, is going to get better law cheaper. It's going to come at the expense of the traditional artisan lawyer, though.
You know, Michael Trotter, I was reading that last fall, Congress is going at looking at the American Bar Association and law schools, a couple of hundred law schools, and putting pressure on them, saying that they've got a lot of complaints that these colleges are misleading students about job prospects, leaving graduates with loans they can't afford to pay. Barbara Boxer and Tom Coburn here, Democrat, Republican, saying the confluence of growing enrollments, they want to look at the confluence of growing enrollments, steadily increasing tuition rates, and allegedly sluggish job placement. People coming out with more than $100,000 in debt, saying that there's behind this, you've got sort of a law school industry that's pumping too many grads out with too much debt into a profession or service industry that's not going to support them, Mr. Trotter.
Tom, I'm afraid you're right about that. Law schools on the whole are very profitable to the universities that run them. They have large classes, a relatively small, high student-teacher ratio. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal several years back that said that there were some law schools where as much as 70-80% of the revenue generated went to other parts of the university,
mm-hmm,
to support their overhead and their other programs.
Profit centers for the broader university.
For most, they are. Some of the Harvard, Yale, probably 5-10% of the gross goes to the university for overhead, and the others somewhere in between. But a lot of money is flowing out of law school to the other programs in the universities.
And so some heat on there as Congress looks in to see what's going on. Bob in Stowe, Vermont. Thanks for calling, Bob. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I think I'm an attorney and member of the ranks of the unwashed. And I think, you know, you have to look at the decline in attorney salaries and sort of a long-term perspective. For one thing, we're in an age of shortage now. The World War II generation, my parents' generation, built wealth. Subsequent generations monetized it and over-collateralized it. And people, you know, and we're paying for that now. In addition, you know, the first world, you know, the United States, used to live off the third world. But the third world is now the first world. And we're all competing for, you know, the third world, India, China, even some of the Central European nations. We're everyone's first world, and we're competing for scarce resources, especially in terms of energy. You know, people talk about World War One was to make the United States, the world safer democracy. It was really about who's going to get access to the Chinese coal fields. And attorneys just charge too much, and we're all chasing the same dollar.
So what's it mean down the road, Bob? Is it going to be maybe, I don't know, some empty country club memberships, but will it be cheaper law for the average American citizen or not?
Well, I think some of you, that's a good question. I think, you know, your guests and some of the people who've called in made some, you know, very nice comments about how there are markets available that have been untapped. For example, the woman who said, the working man needs, you know, more affordable legal advice. And one of your guests said that, you know, the industry will adapt. It'll become cheaper. One of the things that really worries me about the legal profession is it's lost its moral content. When the circuit judge from, I think she's from Eighth Circuit, Edith Jones, federal circuit judge, and addressed to Harvard, the graduating class at Harvard in 2003, spoke to a much greater problem, is that it's lost its moral and ethical content. Lawyers now will do anything for a buck. And I've seen, you know, the enormous amount of churning, unnecessary discovery, depositions, costing tens of thousands of dollars just to intimidate the other side and run up bills for their clients. There's an enormous amount of unnecessary stuff going on, and the judges really aren't stopping it. It should be an aristocracy of ethical and moral content. But instead, lawyers have become materialists and are more concerned with their corporate and personal interests.
Let me put it, if I may, quickly to Michael Trotter before the break here. Michael, what about it? The financial pressures or desires putting pressure on the moral, what we like to think was some moral content of the lawyer's work.
Tom, lawyers are human beings. And like all human beings, they take into account how they can feather their own nest. And I don't think there's anything fundamentally wrong with that. I think we need to remember that 50% of the lawyers in the United States are sole practitioners. 70% are in firms of fewer than 20 lawyers. And that's a different world from the Dewey LaBeouf world, which is about 10% of the total number of lawyers in the United States.
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the business of law in trouble, the legal profession in the midst of a kind of revolution at the technology level, at the compensation level. A big case going on in New York right now, Dewey and LaBeouf, all kinds of problems, lots of people watching that. But up and down the profession, the service industry, as my guests today are now saying, lots of change going on. William Henderson joins us. He's at the Indiana University's Maurer School of Law. Michael Trotter is with us from Atlanta, Georgia, partner at the law firm Taylor English Duma. Been in the business for the better part of five decades. In a few minutes, we'll turn our eyes toward Beijing, where the blind barefoot lawyer, Chen Guangcheng, is out of the U.S. Embassy. We'll look at the deal that got him out. Bill Henderson, how do you see this industry changing? I don't know, the different sectors of it, the top firms, the single practitioner, the regional firms in between. Who's going to do all right? Who's not going to do well? How's it going to change the profile of the business of law that Americans see?
I think to put it to make it a as simple and as vivid as possible, turn on sports radio and listen to who advertises on sports radio. You'll hear a company like LegalZoom touting their association with
it's a dot com.
Companies. Mm-hmm. It's a dot com. And they say, we're not a law firm, but we can help you solve your legal problems through form documents and various products that they offer. That's financed by non-lawyers. Although some lawyers that were involved in getting it off the ground, it's a rapidly growing company. There's many, many other, I would call them vendors rather than practicing lawyers, that are getting into this space, trying to meet unmet legal need or trying to meet legal need at a better, more competitive price point. But they're leveraging technology and kind of knowledge management principles as opposed to just lawyers looking up answers and doing things on a kind of a time and materials model. So we're seeing this transition, but it's really being driven by non-lawyer investors.
And what about more broadly, Michael Trotter? Not every legal quandary can be poured into a dot-com formula. How do you see the industry shaking out at its different levels?
Tom, there's a major segment of the industry that we haven't mentioned at all yet and is probably the single most important part of the major business practice of law, and that is the in-house legal departments. They were relatively insignificant in the 60s, certainly going into the 70s, but now have become a major force. In 2006, there were probably over 30,000 lawyers working directly for companies as members of their legal departments. These are knowledgeable, competent, sophisticated lawyers who are on the other side of the bargaining table from the big firms that we've been talking about.
So you foresee more in-house legal capacity and less farmed out to big firms?
That is definitely so, and the in-house lawyers are bargaining more vigorously with their outside counsel to reduce their cost. And this is a very well-compensated part of the economy. For instance, last year there were 150 lawyers, in-house lawyers, working for public companies who earned $1 million or more. They're continuing to do well, and I think they will do even better going forward.
That may be the place with the eye of the needle. Looks a little smaller, maybe, or reoriented. Waynesboro, Virginia. Jim is calling. Jim, you're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. I really love your program. I compare it favorably to Frontline.
Thank you.
I have been a practicing lawyer in both private sector and public sector work for the government. I had the privilege of serving as an assistant attorney general in Virginia for some time.
Mm-hmm.
Over my career, I would certainly agree with the observations of your guest hosts, Mr. Trotter and Mr. Henderson. But what I would also offer up as an observation is this is very similar. The metamorphosis within the legal profession is very similar to the one that has occurred within the banking industry. I would sum it up by saying too much, too many. Too many lawyers seeking too much money and failing to meet the needs of our clients rather than self-serving activities meeting our own financial interests, which especially in the banking industry, would be characterized as greed, and it has been characterized in greed, for example, on the Frontline program, Power, Money, and Wall Street.
Sure. Jim, let me give it right there, if I may. Our time is so short, but you look at greed as a problem, and maybe so. If that's tipped over, we could see a lot of change on the back of it. I want to get one more. Thank you, Jim. Dave in Des Moines, Iowa. Dave, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom, I think it's great, the democratization of lawyers. Maybe now they'll get religion and become public defenders or environmental lawyers. I mean, a small town in the Midwest can offer a lawyer a nice paycheck for a long time when they have the pressures of the student loans coming due. That's all I have to say.
We love it, Dave, and I appreciate your call as well. Bill Henderson, is that the future here? Lawyers going in eyes wide open in new direction, not such big dollar signs in them. Is that what's coming?
I think that is correct. And anybody who enters the legal profession, graduates from law school now and going forward in the future, expect to be very adaptable and acquire new skills and learn to collaborate with people from other disciplines to help solve problems. But Dave does raise a good point. There is unmet legal demand. You can go and build a practice in and outside of the bigger cities. I think that lots of young people flock to the large cities, but in fact, there's unmet legal need and outside of the big starlit cities.
Michael Trotter, give us the long view. You've been in this for almost 50 years. If there's a young person, you may advise them otherwise, but if they're intending to get into the law, what kind of career should they look toward in this day and age?
There are a number of options, Tom. I think we've mentioned all of them, the sole practitioners, the public defenders, the public employment, smaller firms, medium-sized firms, major firms with hundreds of lawyers or more. I think if they're shooting for the big firms, though, they need to be prepared for extraordinary competition for the top jobs. And a lot may decide to go in-house. The corporate law departments are beginning to hire law students directly from law school, which is a very interesting development.
Mm-hmm.
And will provide an opportunity for some. But if you've incurred $100,000 to $150,000 of debt to finance your legal education, you may not be able to pay that off at these lower-level jobs. And so I think students need to really consider carefully whether it's going to be worth the debt they're incurring to go to law school and be prepared for extraordinary competitive situation if they do incur that much debt.
Well, it's been a really interesting glimpse into a high-profile American industry with its own kind of shaking and baking going on right now. Michael Trotter at Taylor English Duma in Atlanta, Georgia. We're very grateful to you for being with us today. Listeners, look for the new book, Declining Prospects. Yes, sir. Forthcoming. Thanks for joining us, Mr. Trotter.
Thank you, Tom.
And William Henderson with Indiana University's Maurer School of Law joining us today from California. Bill, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks, Tom. It was great to be here.
In a moment, the deal over the fate of China's blind barefoot lawyer, Chen Guangcheng, now out of the U.S. Embassy in Beijing. This is On Point. Chen Guangcheng, China's blind barefoot lawyer and activist, escaped house arrest last month and fled to refuge in the U.S. Embassy in Beijing. Today he's out. A U.S.-China deal over Chen has been done. Jerome Cohen, co-director of New York University's School of Law's U.S.-Asia Law Institute and a longtime confidant of Chen Guangcheng, is with us. He spoke with us yesterday. He's back today. Jerome Cohen, welcome. What happened?
Thanks, Tom. Well, this is one of the historic gambles in U.S.-China relations. The two sides have reached an agreement with Chen Guangcheng to honor his request to stay in China in a meaningful way. The idea is to allow him to study law, which he's always wanted to do, and to allow him to do so in an environment where he will be a lot freer than he was during his 7 years of recent confinement. Eventually, he may be able to study at NYU Shanghai's new branch that will open, including some legal education opportunities there a year from now. And, of course, we would welcome him at some point if he wants to come and be a visiting scholar or whatever in the United States. But immediately what this does is it's an opportunity to give him a chance to play a role in China, not to leave China and get sort of buried the way Chinese dissidents have been buried when they've come to this country. They no longer have an effect in their own country. Chen wants to, he's only 40 years old, continue to have some role in his country and promote the legal system.
Well, I've got all kinds of questions here, Jerome. First, just to his current circumstances. It turns out he was, I guess, in the U.S. Embassy. There was some question about that.
No doubt about it.
And he was there. He was then taken out. He went with three American officials, including the U.S. ambassador to China, to a hospital. Why did they all accompany him?
Because this is a Sino-American agreement. The U.S. wants to show, recognizing the risk this man is taking, he's putting his head right back into the mouth of the dragon that has just been chewing him up for seven years. They want to show that they are giving him the most active support to make sure that the commitments that have been made will be carried out.
Has he been reunited with his family, Jerome?
Yes. His family, in the sense of his wife and two children, are with him in the hospital. That's the first step the Chinese agreed to. And I think the scenario probably calls for his leaving the hospital after a physical checkup and healing whatever wounds he suffered in escaping from his house. And they will choose a place where he will take up residence with his family to study law, not the coercive environment of his home city, Linyi, but a place where he will be free of people who in charge or evidently have little goodwill toward him and have much to fear from his call for investigating their illegal behavior.
Jerome, we know that you've known Chen Guangcheng for a long time, a real confidant. You've been very involved in his life and career as sort of self-taught legal activist here. Have you played a role in the deal that was reached between the U.S. and China?
I have been informed of what's going on and in touch. I can't say more than that.
I think a lot of people will hear these developments with a lot of skepticism and wonder, okay, first he goes to a hospital and we think of, you know, terrible scenes of people, quote unquote, in the hospital, which is can be tantamount to detention. And then there's the U.S. ambassador standing with him, but that's over already. I mean, what's to say that China doesn't swallow him right up, back up into that mouth of the dragon, as you say?
That would lead to the greatest Sino-American crisis we've had. Because then the Chinese government would be going back on its solemn commitments. So they're not going to do that. It's very, very unlikely. The problems will arise, Tom, from the immediate day-to-day implementation and the diffusion of authority in the Chinese government over who makes decisions. I'll give you an example. They're at the hospital. A friend of Mrs. Chen, Miss Yuan Weijing is her name, the wife's name.
Yep.
She calls and says she wants to see her. Mm-hmm. Well, she goes to the hospital and she's told she can't see her. Why not? Because this is under Foreign Affairs Administration, a vague answer.
Mm-hmm.
So this is not a demand to see him. He's a hospital patient. When I go to the hospital, sometimes my friends are barred for certain hours
sure.
and
mm-hmm.
times, etc.
Mm-hmm.
But this is his wife. So who makes that decision? There's some policeman on the beat who has to make a decision, but he doesn't represent the foreign ministry that's been negotiating with the American Department of State people. In other words, itty-bitty decisions have to be made. And they're going to have to have a coordinating group, and they're going to have to work out a strategy. And he's going to have to be free, like other Chinese students, they say, are free.
You know, Jerome, if with respect, again, China's number one priority above all else seems to be stability. Chen Guangcheng seems well-intentioned. People say he's not a dissident. He's an activist for the law in China. And yet, he's kind of naturally, by his character, become a rallying point for people who often find themselves in opposition to the ruling authority there. Has he made some kind of agreement that he's going to lay low, that he won't work as an activist, that he won't pursue the kinds of interests he once did?
No, I don't think so.
So they won't even allow his name on the web. What's going to keep him from getting under their skin again?
They have said he'll have the freedom that other Chinese law students have. And that's a limited but realistic freedom. There is certain freedom. I think The best example we can look to for another innovative kind of creative development is the famous internationally known artist Ai Weiwei.
Mm-hmm.
Ai was held for 81 days. He was released. He's still finishing a one-year bail restriction. That puts him under various restraints within the city of Beijing. Nevertheless, Ai, who is a very clever fellow, has managed to exercise considerable freedom of speech. Sometimes he's been violating the regulations that he's under. He has not been taken back in, but he's managed to operate. The other night, I gave him an award for his human rights performance over Skype, where we heard a speech to several hundred people in New York.
That's pretty incredible. Our time is short. China has asked the U.S. to apologize, as I understand it, for letting Chen into the embassy. Should the U.S. do that?
I don't think there'll be an apology. What I'm looking forward now to is a presidential statement similar to the one just made by Secretary of State, solemnly indicating there are commitments made by the Chinese government and our actions will continue to show that we are monitoring that those commitments will be enforced.
The whole world will be watching. Jerome Cohen, we're out of time. We're very grateful to you for being with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.